Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. On December 13, the New York Times published a very lengthy investigation of how Russian cyber power invaded the U.S. The article is titled The Perfect Weapon, and the reporters did a very thorough examination of the Russian operation based on interviews with dozens of players targeted in the attack, intelligence officials who investigated it, and administration officials who deliberated over the best response. And it reveals, according to the authors, a series of missed signals, slow responses, and a continuing underestimation of the seriousness of the attack. This hour of the program, we're going to be speaking with one of the authors of that report, Scott Shane, national security reporter for The Times. He's written about the nature of terrorist threats, the reorganization of intelligence agencies, secret efforts to reclassify historical documents, and many other areas. His most recent book is on the American terrorist Anwar al-Awlaki, and it is titled Objective Troy, A Terrorist, A President, and the Rise of the Drone. Awlaki was the first U.S. citizen deliberately killed in a drone strike, and his influence since his death in 2011 has only grown. And we are also wanting you to know that Scott is a former Moscow correspondent, and his first book, Dismantling Utopia, was on the Soviet collapse, so he has a keen understanding of Russia. We'll be welcoming phone calls, I would imagine. This report's been getting a lot of attention that you'll have questions for Scott. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can find us on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. Hi, Scott. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. Glad to be with you.
Yeah, and thanks so much for the report. It was just so thorough and fascinating. The cryptic first sign, we'll get to the amazing story behind this, but this sign of a cyber espionage and information warfare campaign devised to disrupt the 2016 presidential election, you write, the first such attempt by a foreign power in American history. It's a big deal.
Yeah, you know, we've all gotten kind of used to reading every day about cyber attacks and hacking, and maybe we've gotten a little blasé about it. Most of it is driven by profit motive, or just, you know, kids goofing around sometimes. And it really wasn't until we got into the reporting for this story that I kind of stepped back and realized that we're, you know, probably 50 years from now, we will think of this as a very significant event in U.S. history. You know, for a foreign power and a, you know, somewhat hostile one to have a very significant effect. You can, you can debate how significant the release of all these documents and emails were to the course of the campaign and the election, the result of the election. But in any case, you know, clearly a notable effect. And, you know, if this were a conventional attack by Russia on the U.S., it would get everybody's attention. This one was sort of a little bit below the radar, and that was one reason we went back to try to reconstruct it.
And was that hard to do? I'm just wondering, with such a huge story, how you knew that you had to talk to this person, you know, who was a tech intern almost at the DNC who didn't take the call from the FBI because he didn't know if it was real or not. I mean, how did you even get that story, which is fascinating?
Well, you know, so often people don't want to cooperate with a story. In this case, the Democratic National Committee and its sister organization, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, and to a degree John Podesta, the chairman of Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign, all of whom were, targets of this attack, they all were willing, you know, they were very chagrined, very angry, in some cases, quite bewildered. And they were actually pretty eager to help. And so they talked to us and, encouraged us to try to get to the bottom of it and understand what we could. So we got a lot of cooperation, and You know, many times, you know, the victims of hacks, especially if they're, say, corporations, really don't want to talk about it because it's just sort of more bad PR. But in this case, you know, the Democratic organizations actually did have a motive to talk. You know, to a degree, they blame the outcome of the election on this Russian intervention. So in that sense, they were, you know, perfectly willing to talk about it.
So for those who haven't heard it, there are so many little stories here that you go, oh, my gosh, if things had been different, what would the outcome have been? But tell the story, for those who aren't familiar with it, of the tech support contractor at the DNC who gets a call from an FBI agent and doesn't believe it's an FBI agent.
Yeah, I mean, this is the kind of story that anyone who works, you know, for a large organization, anyone who works in an office somewhere can probably appreciate and imagine happening at their workplace. An FBI agent got a tip from somewhere, we're not sure exactly where, quite possibly the National Security Agency, the eavesdroppers who track this, you know, the sort of cyber traffic all the time. In any case, the FBI somehow learned that there were hacking attempts against the Democratic National Committee. And the FBI agent called over, was connected to the help desk, and then the help desk said, hey, Yared, to this IT guy, he's a contract employee who basically is tech support, you know, the kind of guy who you would call when your computer's on the blink.
Right.
And so the FBI guy says, you know, we believe there's an attack on your systems. And this gentleman, as you say, wasn't really convinced this was the FBI. I mean, I think he, in some ways he thought he was too unimportant to get a call from the FBI.
Right.
And wondered if it was a prank. But he did, you know, and also the other thing is he was a regular IT guy. He had no knowledge of cybersecurity or certainly cyber investigation, the kind of forensics that are required to look into whether a hack has occurred. But the FBI agent told him that they thought a Russian group that goes by multiple names, but this name that he was given was the Dukes, you know, was breaking in, and he should look for the signs of this. And this guy actually Googled the Dukes to learn about it. So, I mean, but to sort of make a very long story short, that meant that on both sides, you know, this guy told his boss, but his boss was busy with something else, and it never rose up the chain of command at the DNC. And the FBI agent also did not escalate. You know, this was a regular special agent who had called over, but obviously they could have gotten a higher-level FBI official to call over to Debbie Wasserman Schultz, for example, who was the chairwoman at the time of the Democratic National Committee, to really kind of, you know, make sure they paid attention. But what happened instead was you had a series of calls from the FBI to this guy, and sometimes he would return the call, sometimes he wouldn't. Anyway, 7 months would pass from September 2015 till late April before senior officials of the DNC were given new evidence that a second Russian group had hacked their systems. And then they, you know, when it reached that level, they realized this is an emergency. They hired a cybersecurity firm. They shut down their systems to kind of kick out the hackers. And they took all the right steps. But, you know, you have to wonder, well, what if they'd done all that 7 months earlier?
Right.
And would that have prevented any of the theft of documents that took place?
Did the FBI comment on all of this to you?
You know, they gave us a very bland statement for the record, which said that they, you know, that they are always eager to help, you know, anyone who's a victim of hacking. They just, I don't think they wanted to get into a back and forth with the DNC. Some of the DNC officials and others involved in this were quite angry with the FBI for not doing what they thought should have been done, which was to say, you know, if you don't get much of a response from the IT guy, then take it up the chain of command and, you know, have, if necessary, the director of the FBI call the chairman of the DNC and say, we believe the Russian government is hacking your system. It's the middle of a presidential campaign, so the DNC would have had every reason to take that seriously. And, you know, as I said, they did when the word got to the right people.
Mm-hmm. Over at the White House, what information did they have? They obviously had concerns about Russian hacking, and you outlined these in the story as well about what they had done targeting the State Department, the White House, the Joint Chiefs of Staff in 2014 and 15. The president was regularly briefed on all of this. Did they take investigations up a notch at the White House, and were they immediately informed about what was going on at the DNC? And what did they do about the earlier reports about this other serious hacking of important agencies?
Well, this has been obviously a very serious concern of the White House and a bunch of agencies for years now, and they're quite aware that one of these Russian hacking groups had been targeting basically many, many agencies and think tanks and that sort of thing around Washington. They are believed to have gotten inside the State Department, the White House, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, even the top of the military command, into the unclassified systems of those organizations. But you know, you can glean a lot of information. In this case, the information appears to have not reached the White House very quickly either. But when they did get fully briefed on it, they then started thinking about both what they call attribution, which is when are we certain enough, or are we certain enough, or how can we get certain enough as to the identity of the people responsible for the hacks, that we can then make a public statement, and should we make a public statement? And then the second step of that would be, should we retaliate in some way?
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, consumed months of intense discussion.
And did they have a discussion, do you know, about whether or not to make a public statement before the election?
In fact, they did make a public statement before the election, and I think they were under pressure from the Democrats to do it. On October 7th, a month before the election, the Director of National Intelligence and the Secretary of Homeland Security put out a joint statement that went pretty far as these things go. You know, it's sort of the usual slightly indirect language, but for one of those statements, it was a fairly strong statement that this was believed to have been carried out by the Russian government with approval from the highest level. The statement did not name the Russian President Vladimir Putin, but it was pretty obvious who they were pointing at. So, in fact, that did come out a month before the election. One of the complaints that we've heard at the New York Times and has generally been leveled at the media, and that we've had actually some soul searching about and some discussions about, is while we did cover the hacking allegations, the evidence that this was a Russian hack and so on, quite thoroughly. My colleague David Sanger wrote a whole series of stories related to this and sort of put it in the context of hacking generally. But at the same time, we were writing a lot of stories, more sort of gossipy political stories about the contents of the hacked documents.
Right.
So, you know, whether it was emails involving the DNC that showed the DNC was sort of favoring Hillary Clinton in some cases over Bernie Sanders, or whether it was John Podesta's emails about the Clinton campaign, the Clinton Foundation, and so on, You know, we were writing lots of stories about that stuff, too. And so there has been some criticism of the press for treating this, you know, more as a kind of inside look at the Democratic side of the presidential campaign than as a the attack of Russia on U.S. democracy. And, you know, in retrospect, I would say that we perhaps should have made a point of underscoring high up in each story about the sort of political gossip that these emails and this other material was believed to have come from, you know, a Russian hacking attack.
Mm-hmm. And was it building? You talked about the two agencies that had said something, National Security and Homeland Security. Now we've reached a point where we have all of the intelligence agencies saying that this was a Russian operation. You wrote in the December 13th piece, intelligence officials believe this ultimately morphed into an effort to harm one candidate, Hillary Clinton, and tip the election to her opponent. Two questions. Is there widespread agreement now among all the agencies that that indeed was the case? And secondly, whatever happened to the story about whether or not the RNC was hacked?
On the first point, there is, I think, unanimity. As far as we can tell, I think there's unanimity now, certainly that the Russian government was responsible for these hacks. And while initially there was a little bit of a gap between the FBI and the CIA on the question of whether it was intended to help Trump and hurt Clinton, you know, we've been told that they agree on that as well. I think, you know, one thing that in some ways that dispute or that distinction is a bit artificial or overblown because, you know, the U.S. agencies have thought for a long time that Putin's, you know, sort of strategic goal in this instance, but for some years now, has been to damage the brand of U.S. democracy. And the reason for that is he blames the U.S. for meddling in his sphere. He blames the U.S., rightly or wrongly, for encouraging the so-called color revolutions in Ukraine and in former Soviet Georgia. And he blamed the U.S. and, in fact, then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, in particular and by name, for anti-Putin demonstrations that broke out in Moscow in 2011. So, you know, one of the interesting things that I heard from people who have followed this closely is that from Putin's point of view, this attack was retaliation. You know, we're sitting there thinking about, well, should Obama retaliate? Well, from Putin's point of view, he was already retaliating for stuff he thought the U.S. had done. And so there's, you know, but if you think about, you know, his goal in terms of making U.S. democracy look bad so it's less appealing to Russians and to Russia's neighbors, then, you know, the Russians probably, like most U.S. experts, thought Hillary Clinton was likely to win the election.
Right.
So naturally, they would focus on her because, you know, why worry about the loser? Worry about the person who's going to become the president of the United States. And he had this personal animus against Clinton for supposedly stirring up the anti-Putin demonstrations a few years earlier. Well, if you're focusing on Clinton, on the Clinton campaign, and trying to, you know, carry out mischief to undermine that campaign, then by definition you're helping her opponent, Donald Trump. So, you know, I'm not sure that you even really need to decide, or that Putin even needed to decide, I'm going to, you know, help Trump and not just hurt Clinton, because by hurting Clinton, he was helping Trump. So I think there is, you know, pretty broad consensus both in the intelligence agencies and in most of the private sort of cyber research community, that that's what was going on here.
We're going to welcome phone calls. We have a lot more to talk about. It's a very thorough report that the New York Times did. We have yet to talk about the investigations of the Russian hacking. The president, of course, has ordered an intelligence review to be completed before Donald Trump takes office. We'll ask Scott if that's underway, what he might know about that. There are probably going to be at least a couple congressional inquiries into this. And I'm wondering if there's further information about what's happened after the election. This report also says that there have been at least, and this was December 13th, five new waves of phishing emails, evidently from Cozy Bear, from the Russians, aimed at think tanks and nonprofits in the United States. We'll talk about those as well. We have to talk about WikiLeaks. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, that's okay. That's talk@WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and Twitter is @KDunnShow. Scott Shain is national security reporter for The New York Times. He's done a lot of writing about the nature of terrorist threats. He understands Russia pretty thoroughly as well. He's a former Moscow correspondent. He's the author of a couple books. And we're going to be continuing this story in a moment here on the Ideas Network. Before we go to many phone calls that are coming in, Scott, what is the latest with the White House investigation that the president wants completed by January 20th, and also the calls from four U.S. senators for a congressional investigation?
Well, I mean, we don't have any insight into the intelligence review, but the intelligence agencies, you know, I don't think they're doing new work. They're, of course, looking at these Russian hacks all the time. So I think it's more a kind of compilation of the findings of the different intelligence agencies into a report for the president. You know, notably, he wanted it done before he leaves office. As people can imagine, the reason for that is that the president-elect, Donald Trump, has taken a quite surprising, even shocking, approach to this subject. He has repeatedly denied that Russia was responsible for these hacks, suggested that it might be, at different times he said, a 400-pound guy or a guy lying in bed or a guy in New Jersey or maybe the Chinese. And his motive for saying that is a little bit hard to figure. Presumably, he has had intelligence briefings, and presumably, he's been told that the agencies he's about to take command of all believe that this was Russia. Perhaps he doesn't want to give credence to the idea that Vladimir Putin and Russia gave his election campaign a push, but it has set up this rather awkward situation where he's going to be in charge of the CIA, and he's essentially denounced the CIA as a bunch of incompetence and maybe politicized, and said that's the reason they're claiming this was carried out by Russia. So I think with that in mind, partly Obama wanted to make sure to sort of get on the record and in the public mind the you know conclusion of the government's experts that this was in fact Russia. In terms of the congressional inquiries, I don't think that's fully settled yet. Both intelligence committees, you know, have expressed an interest in taking this on. There's a discussion of whether there should be a select committee like the kind that looked into Benghazi or long ago into Watergate, or whether this should just be left in the hands of the intelligence committees. There's also been some people who've called for an independent national commission along the lines of the 9/11 commission. But I think, you know, it seems to be that this is likely to be handled by the intelligence committees, which means most of it will probably be done behind closed doors, but there will probably be some kind of either public hearing or public report that comes out of it. There certainly is bipartisan support for, you know, a thorough inquiry and a thorough understanding of what happened here from Republicans as well as Democrats. So I think that will certainly happen.
Let's go to the first of many phone calls. Jerry in Schulzberg is our first caller for you. Scott, hi, Jerry.
Hi. Thanks for providing a little airtime. Two comments very briefly. I'm hearing the gentleman bleed back and forth between the tactical and the strategic. Now, from the viewpoint of journalism, the most important issue in the early days of this hacking for a lot of folks was not the emails that contained the gossip that the gentleman was referring to, but the more strategic that goes directly to the essence of democracy and truth and reportage, and that is that they were committing espionage against the heart of our culture and our society. And it was not being addressed emphatically enough, nor was it being addressed in a really it was more passive in its reporting. Two, what do we know about the possibility of these PACs that are primarily Republican that go to states and are legally, but going to voter registration rolls and trying to call out as many voters that are registered as possible? Now, here's the point I want to make about the strategic and the tactical. Is there any possibility that the hacking that went on, that somehow these PACs were able to get access to the hacking of the DNC voter rolls? And they used that legally, but they got it surreptitiously to adulterate a lot of the elections in the states.
Scott.
Well, there has been a lot of concern about the possibility, you know, all the way to the White House, that the Russians might attack the election itself. And, in fact, in, I think, three states, there was evidence that hackers had tried to break into the voter rolls. But I don't think there's any evidence, it's been pretty carefully reviewed, I don't think there's any evidence that the voter rolls were changed or voting machines hacked or anything else that happened, in terms of directly influencing who voted or how the vote was counted. So the influence on the election that has come to light is purely through the release of these emails and these documents. And, this sort of came across as a drip, drip, drip and may have been something that didn't make a big impression on people. But if you look back on it, as we did, you realize that, 3 days before the Democratic National Convention in July, the WikiLeaks dumped 44,000 emails, set off this furor, big fight between the Sanders supporters and Clinton supporters. That led to the resignation of Debbie Wasserman Schultz as chairwoman of the convention and several of her aides. So total chaos and a totally distracting story at a time when, you would, obviously the Democrats would have wanted the focus to be on, the virtues of their candidate and the demerits of Mr. Trump. And then the WikiLeaks released other documents that were provided, are believed to have been provided by Russian intelligence, by these hackers, from John Podesta, Clinton's campaign chairman, but they didn't do it all at once. They strung it out over about a month, a few thousand a day, so there was always something new to talk about and write about. So that had a sort of drip-drip effect, and certainly, was pretty, cast quite a pall, I'd say, over the Clinton campaign. Made people sort of think, geez, what's really going on here? It seems to be a lot of backroom dealings, and that cannot have helped her candidacy.
And I know you asked Julian Assange what was going on here. What did he say?
Well, he sort of defended the way they used the material in terms of in legitimately pointing out that a news organization is going to release information, release a story, you know, at the moment when public interest is greatest. So it sort of makes sense to dump the emails right before the Democratic National Convention. And likewise, you know, why dump out all Podesta's emails at the same time? It's too much for everyone to read. So by doing it day after day, you attract a larger audience. That was all legit. He denied that their actions, WikiLeaks actions, were designed to hurt Clinton's candidacy. But when I asked him whether he felt, he had helped elect Donald Trump, he actually did not deny that and sort of bragged about how widely discussed WikiLeaks was on Facebook and in other forums during the campaign. So he's sort of, in a way, taking credit for having a big influence on the election.
Jerry, thanks for your call. Carl in Madison, hi.
Yes, hello, Kathleen. I'm visiting from the wild and woolly coast of Oregon, where I live now, and your voice is just such a wonderful thing. Oregon Public Broadcasting has a great program, but you guys are so special, and this is such a hard topic. I'm hoping for a little holiday cheer from you or your guest in terms of the quandary I find myself in. I feel like they've already won, and when I say they, I mean just anything that smacks of ugliness, of bullying, of casting doubt, casting aspersions on the heart of our democracy. The masterstroke isn't that they hacked into our voting machines. It was that they made us turn against one another and the uglier side of our nature at a time when the country is so vulnerable. And I feel that perhaps the only way forward is through a lot of hurt. I'm not sure that the people who are beating their chests and feeling really good about this disturbing victory are going to be shamed into any other point of view until they feel the pain of what it means to have a demagogue lead the country. And if you look up demagoguery, even on Wikipedia, you get a coloring book page of Donald Trump's candidacy thus far. I'm very concerned about the issue. I don't know how to fight or push back against it without dropping to the ugly vitriol that's been spread by what has got this campaign and the country to where it is now. And at the same time, I hate just standing by and watching it happen. I'm just hoping that there's a shinier, sunnier way to respond than to wait for a descent into what I think is going to be a lot of pain before we get where we need to go.
Thank you, Carl. Have a good life in Oregon. Scott, what do you say?
Well, you know, I mean, I'm not... I'm not a philosopher and I'm not a psychologist, so it's a little hard for me to respond to that. I certainly understand. I mean, I guess from my point of view as a reporter, I think what's significant here is that we step back and take note of how significant this hack of the election was. Whether you supported Trump or Clinton, presumably you would not want Russian intelligence to play a significant role in an American presidential election. And yet we seem at this point quite vulnerable. And of course, the Russians also are believed to have played a significant role in the so-called fake news that has gone around, in a way that I don't think I ever imagined growing up, the U.S. Voting system, the U.S. election system, really seems like it is fragile and vulnerable to manipulation. So I totally understand where the caller's sort of depression is coming from.
Thank you, Carl, for your call. Dan sends this message on Facebook. I'd be careful about blaming the Russians, especially when U.S. intelligence agencies declined to publicize the evidence. As you already know, Trump didn't win the popular vote. Hillary won by some 3 million ballots. There appears to have been a significant amount of voter suppression committed by Republicans, I really think that we should target the right target, R-I-G-H-T, target.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, the evidence, you know, I mean, he's absolutely right. One of the things that we thought about in writing this story was that we wanted to make very sure that there was solid evidence and a solid consensus that this was, in fact, the Russian government.
Mm-hmm.
And not somebody else. And so, you know, we talked to a lot of people, not just in the government, but also outside the government. And I did talk to one cyber researcher who didn't say it wasn't the Russian government, but said he was not yet convinced based on the evidence that had been made public. So, you know, there's room for some degree of doubt. But what we were told by multiple cyber researchers, including those at CrowdStrike, which was the private company hired to investigate this by the Democratic National Committee, was that the two groups that are believed to have penetrated the DNC, which, you know, CrowdStrike has given them the nicknames Cozy Bear and Fancy Bear, are both, you know, groups that operate on behalf of Russian intelligence and have been seen in many different situations. And one of the things they said was that if you look at the list of targets of these groups in the past, it sort of eliminates almost everybody but the Russian government, in the sense that, you know, there were attacks against the Republic of Georgia, against Ukraine, against NATO. You know, these were not money-making attacks. These clearly had a political or geopolitical motive. So there's that, and then there's the other part of this is the sort of MO of a group. The way I think of it is that the police in anyone's town can arrive at the scene of a burglary and say, oh, you know, I recognize the handiwork of old Fred,
mm-hmm.
you know, who always uses a ladder and goes in the second floor window and wears gloves and so on. And I think this is essentially the cyber equivalent of that. They're looking at the malware that's installed. They're looking at the networks from which the hackers operate. And, you know, they learn that the sort of signature of a particular set of hackers. But I share his desire for more information. And I hope that, when the intelligence agency's review is given to the president, that at least, you know, part of it, the key conclusions, the key evidence, is declassified and made available to the public, because I think it's important for Americans to you know, believe their government and what these agencies are saying.
Well, it's probably equally important for the new president to believe the intelligence agencies, that the information that he's receiving sporadically, it sounds like, is valid. How can you have a president, and I guess I'm asking how this information, once it becomes public, needs to be presented so that everybody will have a sense that this is true? I mean, we're living in this weird age when you have a president-elect who thinks, as you said, it could be a 400-pound guy in New Jersey or the Chinese or whoever, but who kind of poo-poos what's coming from intelligence because they got Iraq wrong.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that they got Iraq wrong is something that we all ought to keep in our minds all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I've tried, you know, we discussed that explicitly when we're doing the reporting for this. You know, is it possible that the agencies are wrong and that this isn't Russia? So that's one reason we spent a lot of time trying to address that and talk to as many independent experts outside the government as we could. But yeah, it's an unprecedented situation. It's one thing for candidate Donald Trump or, you know, reality TV star Donald Trump to say he doesn't believe the CIA, but for the President of the United States to say he doesn't believe the CIA, which is essentially going to be sending its representatives to brief him every morning, that's a different story. That has, you know, real consequences. And so it's going to be very interesting to see how, whether he backs away from what he said or, you know, how this plays out.
Margaret in Madison, hi.
Hi. Say, Scott, fascinating story and reporting here. I think this is going to be a story that develops to be even bigger than Watergate, because as more and more information comes out to show that a foreign government interfered in the American elections, we are going to depend on reporters like you to keep going after this story, because there's already a concerted effort to push back against this reporting from the administration that's coming in, from the Republican establishment. They want this story to go away. So I hope you'll put on your Woodward and Bernstein cap and keep going after this information, because I think there will be a concerted effort to stop this inquiry, and we need more information every day, and it's proving to be a devastating account of how easily the Russians were able to influence this election.
Thank you, Margaret, for your call. Scott.
Well, she mentions Watergate and Woodward and Bernstein, and, you know, one of the things that we realized as we got into the reporting is that 44 years earlier, there had been a break-in at the DNC, which was then located in the Watergate complex in Washington. And that, of course, turned out to be, an attempt to physically break in and steal documents from the Democratic National Committee. And that led to the Watergate investigation and ultimately the resignation of Richard Nixon as president. And here we were 44 years later looking at a different kind of break-in at the DNC. The tools had obviously changed a great deal, but one of the things that happened while we were actually doing the work was they took the computer that had been hacked, or the one that they'd identified as having been hacked, and put it down in the basement of the DNC beside a filing cabinet that had been jimmied in the original Watergate break-in. So they're side by side now, and hanging on the wall above is the original Woodward and Bernstein story in the Washington Post about a break-in at the DNC that had obviously very remarkable consequences.
More phone calls in a moment. Scott Shane is our guest. We're talking about the December 13th very thorough investigative report on the Russian hacking of the U.S. election. It appeared that day in the New York Times, and there are three reporters on the story. Scott is one of them. Scott is a national security reporter for the New York Times and has written about the nature of terrorist threats. He's the author of a couple books. He's a former Moscow correspondent. His first book is Dismantling Utopia, which was on the Soviet collapse, and he's also the author of Objective Troy, A Terrorist, A President, and the Rise of the Drone. This is the Ideas Network. Bill in Middleton is next. Hi, Bill.
Good morning, afternoon. The USA Today, this past Saturday, front page, headline, is why Trump likes Russians because they financed his condos. You know that he went bankrupt six times. The U.S. banks would not finance him anymore. He turned to the Russians. His children went there, and they gave him the money. He would be poor man, and the Russians helped him, and the Russians now own him. Pays to read that article, USA, this past Saturday.
Gotcha. Thank you very much, Bill. Scott.
Well, I can't vouch for the reporting in USA Today, but certainly there are a lot of reporters at the New York Times and at other places just trying to understand better the relationship between Donald Trump and Russia and Vladimir Putin, in part because, his conduct has been, as we've discussed, somewhat unusual. In essentially rejecting the intelligence agency's conclusion that Russia was responsible for this hack, it does cause a suspicious reporter like myself to wonder, what's behind that? Is that just his, personal opinion, or is there some reason why he is particularly inclined to defend Russia, to disbelieve the accusations about Russia? And if so, what's behind it? So, we're going to be looking at the real estate deals, money issues, Trump's visits to Russia, the Miss Universe contest that he owned for a period of time, and that took place in Russia 1 year. All of that is getting serious looks from my paper and from other media organizations.
Tony in Egg Harbor, hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi, Scott. Great reporting. This whole idea of emails and hacking just intrigues me, because emails have really only been in mass production for maybe the last 20 or 25 years. And I would say hacking's probably been, you know, really picking up steam within the last 10 years. Hacking and emails didn't invent bad political behavior, but it sure enabled it. What's next after emails? Do we have to go back to trench coats with guys meeting on the corner? Or is this just going to be a phenomenon that we're going to live with forever, and politicians are going to continually use this easy way of communicating their nefarious behaviors?
I mean, that's a great question. I think, you know, certainly doing this reporting made me more conscious than ever of the vulnerability of anything that you put, especially into email. And I was aware of that already. I've had my emails obtained by, under Freedom of Information requests, my emails to government agencies, and made public. I've had some emails turn up in criminal leak investigations and that sort of thing. So I was already pretty aware of that. One thing that, for example, John Podesta had not done to his Gmail account, and that everybody should do as soon as this show is over, is, if they haven't done it already, is if they have Gmail or Yahoo Mail or anything like that, make sure they put two-factor authentication, which is just a security procedure that links it usually to your cell phone. It makes it much, much, much more difficult for your Gmail to be hacked. I did a few years ago, and most reporters I know have done it. But everybody should do that. It's definitely one step that can protect your communications from these hackers.
A couple emails that have come in. Let me give you both of them. Matt sends this: the Comey release of emails 11 days before the election did more to undermine the Clinton campaign than the Russian hacking story that really wasn't focused on until after the election. Not sure why the head of the FBI, a Republican, is getting a pass on this. And Lou sends this information: don't you think that they found dirt on Trump, which they have to have found? Will they be saving that to use as leverage when he's in office?
Well, both good questions. I mean, the Comey statements about the FBI's investigation into Hillary Clinton's use of a private email server and the alleged inclusion of some classified emails in the thousands and thousands of emails that were on her unclassified server. I mean, there's no question that the Comey statements, you know, had an impact. It's basically impossible to say with any degree of certainty whether that was a greater or lesser impact than the Russian hacks and subsequent release of other stuff. There are many Democrats certainly who believe that those two factors together might have made the difference and determined that Donald Trump would be the next president and not Hillary Clinton. But I think that will be debated for decades to come. The second question was
Second question was Trump, that they must have information on him.
Well, I realize I didn't answer your question about the Republican National Committee.
Right.
We still are reporting on that. It's been a little bit difficult to get to the bottom of it because some senior government officials have said that the RNC, the Republican National Committee, was definitely hacked. The RNC itself has said that it has not been hacked and that it's heard that from the FBI. Apparently, there is a question of essentially a private company that worked on contract with the RNC storing data that may have been hacked. The reason any of this is important is that if we found that the Russians obtained interesting emails from the Republicans and did not make them public while making public the emails from the Democrats, that would show that they were sort of taking sides. But I think we still don't know the whole story of what happened with the RNC.
Oh, it's hard to get the truth, isn't it, Scott? It's a long process for you. Thank you so much for this excellent report. It's just the best around. And thank you for being with us, sir. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much. My pleasure.
Scott Shane, our guest. The piece is in the New York Times, December 13. Our Facebook page will have it posted. It's the Kathleen Dunn Show. Thanks very much to KP Whaley and Scotty Myers for producing this interesting show and for the Times for doing that report. We'll return.